The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodkey from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2018 issue of Discover Magazine. Our first article is entitled, Going Ballistic. Next-gen tech is transforming a century-old science. Shots rang out across a Phoenix apartment complex one cool desert night last December. A patrolman arrived to investigate. Cleophas Cooksey Jr., 36, answered his knock at the door, covered in blood. His mom and stepdad were dead inside. Within just days, short work for crime-solving, detectives discovered that distinct markings on the bullets from the apartment matched others from violent crime scenes across the Phoenix area. Cooksey's guns ultimately led him to 9 gruesome murders that had occurred over a 3-week period. The quick analysis came thanks to a new digital technique for comparing the markings on bullets. It's a long-awaited technological update that removes subjective human interpretation and, once widely adopted, could revolutionize solving violent crimes. Forensic scientists around the world currently rely on a roughly 100-year-old tool called a comparison microscope, which offers a split view to study two objects at once. The technique works for ballistics analysis because ammo metal is soft, while the metal in a gun's barrel is hard. This leaves bullets scraped, scratched, and nicked as they're loaded and then fired. Two bullets with the same characteristic markings likely came from the same gun, tying weapons and their owners to crime scenes. Ballistics comparison gained fame following the St. Valentine's Day massacre in Chicago in 1929, when Al Capone's men mowed down 7 rival mobsters with Tommy guns. Early forensic scientist Calvin Goddard used a comparison microscope to match crime scene bullets with guns from Capone's thugs, helping close the case in the public's mind. For many decades after Goddard looked at those bullets close up, things changed little with few advancements. Meanwhile, the technique became nearly universally used. American investigators now collect hundreds of thousands of cartridge cases at crime scenes every year. And even local labs can afford a comparison microscope to run analyses. Yet this analysis is still based on opinions, albeit those of experts in police crime labs. Robert Thompson, a 30-year-old veteran forensic scientist who works at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, compares modern ballistics to a doctor diagnosing a patient with the flu. He can check common symptoms to reach a diagnosis. That is still subjective, he says. Without testing, the doctor can't offer odds that his diagnosis is right. A 2009 National Research Council report, created at the direction of Congress with authors including leading judges, medical examiners, and forensics experts, found troubling problems with the way we evaluate criminal evidence overall. Major crime labs had shut down over unacceptable error rates, and in one case, a judge ruled ballistic evidence couldn't be called scientific in court. The forensic science system, they discovered, often lacked scientific rigor and uniform standards. It needed an overhaul. Since then, NIST scientists have worked on a matchmaking method for the modern era. It relies on modern 3D imaging and computer analysis. A team that includes Thompson, led by NIST forensic scientist John Song, recently revealed the start of a technique that moves the field into the 21st century. They begin by taking a 3D image of the crime scene bullet. Then they test fire the suspected gun and scan those casings too. Each becomes a 3-dimensional virtual object that lets algorithms mimic and compare surfaces. Their big breakthrough came from an algorithm that automatically divides the bullet or casing into small sections of interest, discarding regions that aren't useful. Then the program assigns a numerical score to every match. It's designed as a universal method to augment the existing one, adding numerical precision to a system that relies on eyeballing the evidence. In every measurement, there is a degree of doubt, and what we're doing is measuring that, says Thompson. It's not a simple matter. The team has scanned thousands of cartridge cases to amass a data set big enough to gauge the likelihood that more than one gun could produce identical marks on casings. Other forensic scientists are creating similar databases. and the 3D images reveal more detail than an examiner could see under a microscope, helping find criminals and secure convictions. The technique could one day help other contact-based evidence, like shoe prints and fingerprints. It also could someday create much faster ballistic comparisons, letting detectives connect violent crimes by simply scanning bullets and asking the computer to find a match, be it the gun of a potential serial killer in Phoenix, a mob boss in Chicago, or just a petty crook in any town, USA. Our next article is Science Smackdown. Is everything old new again? Scientists debate whether brain cells are created throughout life. Once you become an adult, it's all downhill for your neurons. You can lose them, but you can't gain any more. That was the prevailing theory until research over the last two decades convinced scientists that older brains do create new neurons, a process called neurogenesis. Neurons are added to two regions of the brain, most notably the hippocampus, where they may contribute to the region's role in learning and memory. Or maybe not. The neurogenesis debate was recently reignited. In Science Smackdown, we let experts argue the evidence. Providing the claim, not a single new neuron, is Arturo Alvarez Boyola. In a March paper in Nature, researchers at the University of California, San Francisco, said they couldn't find any evidence of adult neurogenesis. If it happens, it is a very rare phenomenon, says Arturo Alvarez Boyola, senior author of the paper and a developmental neuroscientist at UCSF. Using a staining technique that highlights proteins only present in new neurons, the researchers identified neurogenesis in tissue samples from fetuses and infants, validating their technique. But the number of new cells sharply fell through childhood, and they found no new neurons in adult brains. If neurogenesis occurs at the level others claim, we would expect to see many, many of them in many different regions, says Alvarez Boyola. Now the counterpoint, hundreds a day. And this is provided by Maura Boldrini. Not even 1 month later, a paper in Cell Stem Cell stated the opposite. Up to hundreds of neurons are added daily throughout adulthood. Maura Boldrini, author of the paper and neurobiologist at Columbia University, says her team stained for similar proteins but preserved the brain tissue with a more consistent method and preserved the samples faster, ensuring proteins didn't degrade. They also examined the entire hippocampus, while the UCSF group studied only three hippocampal slices from each brain. Furthermore, Boldrini verified that her subjects didn't have psychiatric disease or have medication, drugs, or alcohol in their systems, which can affect neurogenesis. Without this patient history, I was a little surprised the other group's conclusion was so strong, she said. Alvarez Boyola counters that Boldrini's staining may be labeling other types of cells, but he doesn't mind the controversy. Progress comes out of this disagreement, he says. We are both trying to look for the truth. Our next article is The Crux, that word you heard. Benthic. Under the sea, all the way at the bottom, is what marine researchers refer to as the benthic zone. It's the lowest layer of the ocean, of any body of water really, including any sediment. It's home to many bottom-dwelling critters like sponges and seaworms that experts call benthos. The region is not always as deep down as you'd think, either. In oceans, the benthic zone starts at the shoreline and follows the continental slope to the deepest depths. And our next section is trending. Game time. From football hooligans to post-playoff riots, watching sports can seem like a violent activity. But the social pastime of settling in for the big game might actually help curb crime. A study from the University of California, Davis, found that in Chicago, a city known for its sports franchises as well as its crime, reports of lawbreaking dropped when games were on. There was a drop in crime when the Bears play in Monday Night Football by 13%, when the Super Bowl is on by 26%, when the NBA Finals are on by 3%, when the Bulls are in the playoffs by 2%, when the World Series is on by 2%, and when the White Sox are in a playoff game by 7%. Degrees of separation, from screen time to ancient footprints. 1 hour. After spending more than this much time on screen devices, teams reported being unhappier than if they had ditched their devices before the 60-minute mark. And the longer they spent glued in front of a screen, the unhappier they reported feeling. 800 million. The number of UK-based tweets researchers examined to learn how the way we think changes throughout the day. Using a text analysis program, the team found that early morning tweets, peaking at around 5 to 6 a.m., were associated with analytical thinking. Night owl tweets, peaking around 3 to 4 a.m., correlated with more existential and social topics. 1.36, the factor by which wild mammals have increased the amount of time they're active at night, all thanks to us. For instance, if an animal once evenly split its time across day and night, around areas with human activity, that animal now spends 68% of its time doing things at night. And it doesn't matter where you're looking, the researchers' findings were consistent across species, continents, and habitats. 75%. Higher than normal light pollution is one of the culprits behind this significant percentage decrease in the biomass of flying insect populations over the last 20 plus years. When the drop was first reported in 2017, researchers pointed to a climate change and land use as culprits. Now, a 2018 paper adds light pollution to the list. 541 million years old, the age of the oldest known footprints. The tracks, discovered in China, weren't human, of course. They were made by an unknown primitive bug. These little prints predate the oldest known tracks by around 10 million years. And 13,200 years old, roughly how old researchers believe human footprints unearthed in Western Canada are. The prints are from at least three different people, including a child. And if researchers can confidently date them, they would be the oldest known human footprints in North America. Starts and stops. For more than a century, geologists have been interested in the San Andreas Fault Zone, or SAFZ. The 800-mile-long system of faults in Western California, where the Pacific and North American tectonic plates meet. The plates grind against each other as they drift northwest at different speeds, the root of several major earthquakes in modern history. The most destructive of these quakes happened around the turn of the 20th century, and experts warn we're overdue for another. Until recently, geologists thought the SAFZ's central sections, home to cities like San Jose and San Luis Obispo, moved at a steady creep, releasing energy in a way that would avoid major earthquakes. But a paper published in June in Nature Geoscience suggests otherwise. It seems the plates have inched along in a series of so-called stick-slip movements. Over the years, these plodding stop-start shifts have caused a string of slow mini-quakes, most of them too minor for us to notice. However, they've also built up pressure between the plates along the SAFZ's northern and southern sections, where metropolises like San Francisco and Los Angeles sit. Current models don't account for these stick-slip movements, which means quake forecasts will need updating. They include an image below that shows stick-slip movements directly along the fault near Parkfield, California, a settlement in the SAFZ's central area that experienced a magnitude 6 earthquake in 2004. Blue signals indicate periods of below normal movement and red above normal, with black being the most intense. This heightened activity doesn't always lead to a quake, though. For instance, in mid-2006 and again in late 2008, going into 2009, the same area on the fault that triggered the Parkfield event saw other significant bursts of stick slips without full-scale quakes. Our next section is Vital Signs, Low Note, A Teenage Girl's Changing Appearance and Voice Baffle Doctors. Sydney's morning routine didn't start like her girlfriend's. She stood in front of a bathroom mirror, splashed her face with warm water, squirted a dollop of shaving cream on her palm, lathered up her face, and began to shave. Until recently, Sydney's face was hairless, like any other teenage girl. The whiskers had begun as a few strands on her chin. She shrugged it off. Her grandma and aunts had some hair on their chins, too. Perhaps this was just part of growing up, she thought. But now it was impossible to ignore. It had become a beard. When she skipped a morning shave, her classmates noticed. They called her Bearded Lady and Circus Freak. Her only remaining joy at school was choir, but even that was losing its fun. A promising soprano, Sydney usually was chosen for solos, but recently the choir director had passed her over. It's weird, she says, her voice unusually deep for a 17-year-old girl. Over the last few months, I had to change sections. Now I sing tenor with the boys. She sat slumped on the exam table, her eyes downcast. I could see stubble on her chin and cheeks, as well as tufts of dark hair peeking out of her button-down shirt. Sydney was also gaining weight, had bad acne, and hadn't had a period in months. At Sydney's first visit to our clinic a year ago, she complained of similar symptoms. The doctor checked her hormone levels. He discovered that the teen's insulin and testosterone levels were higher than normal. This suggested that she had polycystic ovarian syndrome, or PCOS, a common endocrine disorder in women. PCOS causes hormonal imbalances leading to enlarged dysfunctional ovaries and complications like irregular menstruation, infertility, excess body hair, and acne. He advised a standard regimen of exercise, a healthful diet, and a drug called metformin, which helps the body's insulin work more efficiently. But despite taking her medications, reducing sweets, and hitting the gym daily, Sydney was heavier and hairier when I examined her, and her menstrual periods had gone from infrequent to none. It's pretty rare for a teenage girl's periods to stop. Causes can be pregnancy, stress, or rapid weight loss. Other possibilities are an autoimmune disease, drugs, primarily antipsychotics and steroids, or hormonal imbalances resulting from glandular disorders. A urine test showed Sydney was not pregnant, and other than bullying, she couldn't identify any big stressors happening before her period had stopped. PCOS could explain her hair growth, weight gain, and change in periods, and even the change in her voice. But Sydney's symptoms were extreme. A teen girl's voice might be hoarse and soft from acid reflux or from strain after speaking too much, but that would not make the voice deep, like a boy going through puberty. When considering all her symptoms, it seemed as if Sydney were developing into a man. I still suspected Sydney had PCOS, but I wanted to be absolutely sure. I sent her back to the lab for more testing than she had previously had during her visit the previous year. The next day, the lab tech called, concerned. Most of the test results were in the normal range, but one stood out. Her testosterone level was sky high, way beyond a patient with PCOS. It was more than four times higher than an average man's. I initially thought it was a mistake. Maybe the lab's machinery malfunctioned or Sydney's sample got mixed up with another patient's. Few conditions could cause such a dramatic surge of testosterone, but I had a hunch. I called Sydney that afternoon for an ultrasound of her belly, which confirmed my suspicion. Perched on her left ovary was an abnormal mass, likely an ovarian tumor. Most ovarian tumors in teenagers result from cells and tissues of the ovaries growing unchecked. Teens can have several symptoms such as poor appetite, constipation, frequent urination, and stomach pain or bloating, a result of the mass pressing on other organs. But even before the tumors grow large enough to create discomfort, they can secrete sex hormones like testosterone or estrogen, causing exaggerated symptoms of puberty. Sydney's eyes widened and her mouth dropped when I told her the news. "A tumor is doing this to me," she murmured. "You mean I'm not just supposed to have a hairy chin like my aunties?" Her mother sat quietly as I explained the next steps. Prompt surgery to remove the mass, along with the attached ovary and fallopian tube. We would then examine it to see if it was an ovarian tumor and cancerous. Later that week, Sydney was in surgery, placed in an anesthetic slumber, as the surgeon cut into her lower abdomen and delicately removed the softball-sized mass. He placed it in a metal dish for transfer to a pathologist for detailed inspection. The pathologist's evaluation clinched the diagnosis, a Sertoli-Leydig cell tumor. In the fetal state, both sexes have cells that eventually develop into sperm cells for males and egg cells for females. Sertoli-Leydig tumors develop from these early embryonic cells. The tumor is composed of cells normally found in the male testicles, Sertoli cells, which help nourish sperm as they develop, and Leydig cells, which secrete testosterone and other typically male hormones. It's created by abnormal development of the testicular cells. These tumors account for less than 1% of ovarian tumors in females and less than 1% of testicular tumors in males. Most females diagnosed with such a tumor are in their teens or 20s. It's usually not cancerous and does not return or spread beyond the ovary. but it can release huge amounts of testosterone, telling a genetically female body to develop features of a typical man: body hair, a beard, a deep voice. A few months after her operation, Sydney returned for a follow-up visit. Her tumor was benign, so she didn't need chemotherapy. Her scars were healing, and she was thankful to still have her right ovary, leaving open the possibility of natural motherhood someday. Her testosterone had returned to normal levels of a teenage girl, and she was having regular periods. Her face was free of acne and whiskers. Since she no longer needed to shave, Sydney's razor was relegated to the back of the bathroom cabinet. And with her bullying classmates chastened by news of her tumor, the daily taunts had stopped. During our visit, Sydney told me about an upcoming concert by her high school choir. "I was picked for the soprano solo," she said, beaming. She was back to hitting the high notes. And now here's a fun article called 16 Times We Didn't Find E.T. For decades, humanity has been searching for aliens. Here are the false alarms. It's never aliens, until it is. That's been the story for the nearly 60 years the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, or SETI, has been officially underway. You can stretch that date back even further if you count a 1924 military campaign to listen for radio signals from Mars as it reached its closest opposition in more than a century. But in all that time, we've come up with nothing. Thanks to Yuri Milner, a venture capitalist who made billions through big tech investments, more money than ever is going into SETI research. Milner initiated an investment of $10 million a year for a decade in 2015, all with the hopes of finally hearing an alien signal. That process may involve a few false positives for which an all-too-earthly cause is ultimately found. They can add themselves to this list, a guide to many of the times we thought maybe, just maybe, we were finally no longer alone in the universe. 1960. SETI's first dedicated search, called Project OSMA, begins an observing campaign of nearby stars. The team, including Frank Drake, thinks they receive a signal from Epsilon Uragae that ends up being terrestrial. 1965. Soviet astrophysicists Nikolai Kardashev and Osif Skolovsky claimed that CTA-102 almost assuredly shows signs of an alien civilization due to its massive radiation output. CTA-102 is later found to be an active quasar. 1967, Jocelyn Bell Burnell finds a radio signal repeating every 1.3 seconds. At a loss for an explanation, she and her PhD advisor term it LGM-1, short for Little Green Men. In the end, it becomes the first discovered pulsar. 1976, the Viking 1 labeled release experiment on soil on Mars shows signs of nutrient metabolism in one of four tests for Martian life. However, two other tests are inconclusive, while a fourth is negative. 1977, the Big Ear Observatory in Ohio picks up a signal that causes Ohio State University researcher Jerry Eamon to scrawl, "Wow!" due to its intensity and frequency. The 72-second signal never repeats, leaving it a mystery. 1983. French astronomer François Béraud and SETI pioneer Jill Tarter detect a signal over the course of three nights. When the telescopes are recalibrated, it turns out to be interference from the Paris airport. 1990. Australian astronomers catch a strong signal coming from the direction of HD 157881, a star on Ophiuchus. The signal gradually fades and never repeats. 1996. NASA announces that the Mars meteorite ALH84001 appears to show evidence of microbial fossils. Debate rages over the structure's origins, but the general consensus is that they are not fossilized Martians. 1997. The SETI Institute picks up a narrowband signal during a telescope upgrade. Rather than aliens, it is the Solar and Heliospheric Observatory, a solar-observing satellite. 1998. The Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico detects a signal from the direction of EQ Pegasi. 10 minutes later, it repeats, but a third repetition from a different area of the sky shows it was likely terrestrial. 2004. A Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory search for theorized artificial structures called Dyson spheres turns up 23 candidates, all of which are eventually identified as natural sources of star dimming. 2004. Reports claim that SETI at Home has detected three separate bursts from a region between Pisces and Aries. The signal, called SHGBO2+14A, ends up being a chance coincidence from different regions of the sky. 2012. The Green Bank Telescope picks up signals from two Kepler targets, KOI-817 and KOI-812. While the signals appear artificial, they turn out to be terrestrial in origin. 2015. A star called KIC-8462852, Tabby Star, experiences massive dimming events. Several hypotheses emerge, including Dyson structures. Subsequent observations, however, rule those out. 2015. The Russian Rattan 600 radio telescope receives a signal from the direction of the star HD 164595. After a brief meteor storm, it's discovered to be a Russian military radio signal. And finally, in 2016, two French-Canadian researchers claimed that 234 stars from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey show artificial beacons. At least three referees urge them not to publish, and the results aren't taken seriously. And now from the inbox is some print feedback. One letter is called, "What's Wrong with Octopi?" in response to Everything Worth Knowing, Octopuses, from the July and August 2018 issue. I've been reading Discover since the first promotional issue hit my mailbox eons ago, and I look forward to every issue. I love the latest Everything Worth Knowing issue, especially the enlightening article on Listeria. The main reason I am writing, though, is octopi. I've often wondered why it became octopuses, which I find terribly awkward. I will now go with octopedes and confuse everyone. Thank you so much for keeping the magazine as excellent as it has always been. That is from Roy Bezajowski from Meridian, Connecticut. Another letter is Trippy Treatment, and this is response to the Into the Mystic article from the April 2018 issue. I was excited to see this article, and I hope to hear about more research on the therapeutic benefits of psilocybin. I would like to see the Drug Enforcement Administration reclassified as a lower-risk drug, so researchers and medical experts could have easier access and conduct larger, more in-depth studies. It's widely believed to be an effective treatment for depression and anxiety, with far fewer harmful side effects than pharmaceuticals. More importantly, it sounds promising as a method of alleviating pain and fear in cancer and terminally ill patients. Those benefits would extend beyond the patient to relief for family and friends and even medical staff. And that letter was from Amanda Errante in Florissant, Missouri. We have run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodkey, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138.